This podcast is sponsored by Rode Microphones, the choice of today's creative generation. Small HD, real-time confidence for creatives.
Hey everybody, this is Charles Hain coming to you from Sundance 2020 with another one of our roundtables. This is the Cinematographer's Roundtable. We actually ended up doing there were so many interested cinematographers that we ended up doing two roundtables. This is the first of two. And roundtables are a really great opportunity to get a bunch of people together to talk about how they landed the projects that got them there, what they're noticing changing about the industry, what they're enjoying about the festival. So I hope you enjoy this one.
Hey, this is Charles Hain here with No Film School at Sundance 2020. We're doing the first of two cinematographers roundtables. I'm sitting here at a table with six cinematographers who have projects here at Sundance this year. So if you guys could just introduce yourselves, starting on my right, and who you are and what project you are here with.
My name is Kenny Suleymanagic. I'm here with a short film called Three Deaths.
My name is Carlos Rossini, and I'm here with a film called Vivos by Ai Weiwei.
My name is Wolfgang Held. I'm here with two films that I shot parts of. One is called Boys State, and the other one is called Rebuilding Paradise by Ron Howard.
I'm Juan Pablo Ramirez. I'm here with I Carry You With Me, Heidi Wins.
I'm Jenny Morello. I'm the cinematographer of Us Kids, and I also shot a little bit of Rebuilding Paradise.
I'm Eric Bronco. I'm here with The 40-Year-Old Version.
Oh, yeah, The 40-Year-Old Version. Sorry, I didn't say something about everybody else's thing, but Eric was the last person, so I could be like, oh yeah, that's on my list of things I'm excited to see. I'm aware a lot of people got here already. Usually in these roundtables, we talk about what people have seen, but it's really early in the festival, and I know a lot of you just got here, so we're not going to do that. But, you know, roundtables are always awkward at the beginning, but if we can, like, it'll flow better as we go, but if we could kick off with, like, how you ended up getting attached to the project that you got on, because that's always a question people wonder, like, how did it come to be that you were on this movie that ended up going to Sundance? There's no obligation to, like, go in a circle. I'm going to actually start with Carlos and be like, how did you end up working with Ai Weiwei? Because that's fascinating to me.
Yeah. Ai Weiwei went to Mexico to visit a museum that was offering a showing for him. And he was deciding, and he got involved in knowing the subject of the documentary, which is the 43 student that disappeared in the state of Guerrero. And he immediately got interest in making a film about it. So he was in contact with a couple producers that are a friend of mine, and they start introducing him people, and he didn't like. So I was finishing a project, and I film in difficult places, and I'm a DP and a director. So they decided that was the moment for us to talk. So we met by Skype a couple of times, and then we managed to form a team to do the film.
Oh, that's awesome. Which museum was it?
MUAC, University of Contemporary Arts in the UNAM, the University Museum in Mexico City. Amazing museum.
Awesome. Yeah. Mexico City has a lot of amazing museums.
Yeah.
although I think Carlos Slim's one's a little overrated, personally, if I can just say something that is a little bit controversial. I was a little disappointed.
We can agree with that.
Okay. All right. So maybe it's not controversial. All right. So it was a very traditional way, like unconventional, like you don't think of as being a filmmaker, but a very traditional process of, like, they went out, they found producers, it was producers you'd worked with in the past, and so it was a very traditional introduction.
Yeah, something like that. I never worked with them, but I'm a producer, so I work with them in different things. They used to be in film festivals, the producers. So we met before, and I made different films. And they introduced me because they were, like, he was looking for something really abstracting his words. So he saw the films I shot and he was like, okay, now we're talking.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you've now said you're a director, you're a cinematographer, and you're a producer.
I'm sorry.
No, it's 2020. Everybody does everything. Like, how many people at this table are 100% pure DPs and they do nothing but shoot?
I am, yeah.
Oh, gotcha. So about three. And then the other.
Excuse me.
The other three people at the table shoot but also do other things? Could you guys talk about that?
I mostly work as a DP, but I'm currently starting to direct my first feature doc.
Oh, awesome. And then...
Yeah, I I'm primarily a DP. I have kind of a side hustle directing concerts, live concerts.
Oh, gotcha. Which is like very different from being a, like, it's related, but it's not like the same at all.
It's similar. It's managing people.
Yeah. Multi-hyphenates is sort of the modern career in a lot of ways.
Sometimes I wish I only do one thing, but it's I get interested in many projects at the same time, and I do them.
Yeah, a project comes like up. And then Juan Pablo, how did you end up joining on your project?
Well, Heidi was planning a doc in Mexico, and it was about two characters that couldn't leave the state, so she needed like another unit in Mexico. She was going to travel to Mexico, and she needed a DP. I was considered to be the one, but I couldn't at that moment. And after, I think, 2 years, I got a call, like, she wanted to talk to you about the feature film and a narrative film about the same subject. And we started to Skype and got into deep conversations about the theme and how to shoot it and how would it be to shoot a narrative coming from a director that it's used to shoot only docs. So that's when I got in, basically.
Oh, gotcha. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
And then, Wolfgang, you have two projects that are both here.
Yeah, I think the more interesting story is Texas Boys State. I was actually hired by another cameraman, a friend of mine. I have this camera collective in New York. There's six of us. There's two women and four guys, and we all shoot documentary. We have fiction background. And this film, Texas Boys State, my friend Torsten, who founded this camera collective with me, he and Torsten Tilo, he basically asked me and some of other camera collective members to come along to do a verite film where each of us took one of the characters of this event of 5 days. I shot a whole documentary in 5 days of these 17-year-old kids running through the Texas Boys State event where they make a mock government and elect governors and they try to understand the political process. So every one of our collective members that was there, four of our six came and two other people, took one character and we put a mic on them and followed them. And at some point they intercrossed and who made it and who didn't and why. And so that's sort of the reason I came in to that project. So Torsten had worked with Jesse Moss, the director, and he asked our camera collective members to come.
Well, and that's nice because you guys all have an understanding of each other, so it's not necessarily something... You end up on projects sometimes where there's six operators or whatever, and you're not necessarily in alignment, but you guys all actually know each other and work together presumably pretty often. How long has Camera Collective been around?
We've been around for 5 years now, I guess, and we all sort of love verite. We hate reality TV, and we love verite, you know, yeah. Documentary, so there's this fine line, and I think that's why we wanted to do this together, so we're a verite team.
Awesome. All right, that's very cool. And then Jenny?
Well, one of them, Wolfgang and I are on the same project, but I think it's funny, like it was like January of 2018. It was like right after Sundance and I was having tea in New York with the director of our film just because we were trying to figure out a way to work together. And she was obsessed with she had a project in the works that was going to take place in Florida. So I think it's just weird because she happened to be there when the shooting had happened at the school. So that's sort of kind of how it happened. I mean, it's like documentaries.
Yeah.
It's like, you know.
They evolve.
Yeah.
But how had you originally met that director?
I think we all kind of know each other in the industry. So I think she had been trying, we were planning on working together on something.
Yeah. Eric?
I think Radha and I have known each other for a long time. We met at a festival in Philly called Black Star in 2014. And then actually I was here for the first time in 2017 with a short film I had shot. And we kind of ended up hanging out like a good amount of the weekend. And so, yeah, I got the call for, I think she had seen Clemency also.
Oh, cool.
And kind of knowing me and then seeing that, she was like, okay.
All right.
Cool.
Kenny?
Well, I met the director of Three Deaths. I met him socially a few years ago, and he had actually been in production of a feature. And we kind of stayed in touch as friends and then slowly started working together on little couple-day kind of loose documentary kind of things. And a couple years ago, we moved in together into this apartment that sort of is like a little factory. You know, there's always kind of something going on, and the genesis of this came when something else didn't come through, and we kind of, it was wintertime last year, and we were like, well, many things came together, and we had time, we had resources, and kind of just jumped into it.
Okay. All right, so now a little more of a freewheeling question. Like, how have you guys noticed life as a cinematographer changing in the last couple of years? There's a few things I've noticed where things are getting different on film sets. Like, I feel like angry crew members are less tolerated than they used to be even 2 or 3 years ago. Like, people having ridiculous outbursts is just something that, like, the industry is changing their opinions about. Obviously, Me Too is changing the way a lot of things are handled on set. So, like, what are you guys noticing as the last couple of years gone by that things are different or changing? Or maybe nothing has changed. Maybe it feels exactly the same as it did a couple of years ago.
To me, for example, technically speaking, is a lot of lightweight equipment. So cameras are getting smaller and more light. And also the lighting equipment, the output is bigger with a smaller size, and they're not heavier anymore. So you can do a feature with few things now. And it's easier and it's cheaper. And so it's like some sort of democracy about the use of equipment, which is good because now you hear more voices than before, I think. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's very important because, I mean, I've received calls from very experiment directors, but also from very newer directors that have a very interesting voice because they want to try and they don't have, you know, like this experience of doing it in the old way with all structures. So also when you start to working, for example, with artists that jump into visuals and into audio visuals, it starts to make like a soften the edges between how you should work. And that's very interesting to me, you know, like, for example, I did a movie with an artist, mm-hmm, that is more into, you know, like museum stuff. And he asked me for some aesthetic that I wasn't used to, and that's very interesting. And we had to work with almost nothing as equipment because it was we had to deliver this movie with the budget of a piece of art, which in this case was just a little. And to me, having equipment that is less heavy and cheaper makes a really good opportunity to do great stuff.
Awesome.
Just picking on the crew, I find I do both fiction, narrative films, and documentary. I find that, at least in my world, the fiction equipment has gotten smaller. I mean, I've done 2 features now with only practicals and available light, except for night exteriors, and I love working that way, where I just basically don't use movie lights at all anymore. So that reduces some of the crews, and I find the documentaries, at least the ones that I'm going with, they're getting slightly larger crew. They often have a second camera person, there's a drone in the air, you have a movie going around. All that stuff's relatively new, I think, for me anyway, the way I used to shoot documentaries on that zoom lens on those heavy cameras, and now it's, mm-hmm, all prime lenses. So the whole language has changed, and that affects the crews. So when I go to documentaries, crews are often almost like small fiction crews of like 8-9 people in the field. And the narrative crews that I've worked with, they've gone down to like 20-30 people.
Yeah, filming, whereas you used to think of Doc as three, yeah, or four.
Yeah. Say again.
You used to think of Doc as like a 3 or 4 person crew. Right. Very common in a doc. But that's sort of inching up.
Yeah, so it's morphing, and I think it's good to also lose the boundaries of documentary and fiction. And that's what I was always loving, because it's happening now in the language.
Yeah.
And I think it should happen in the films even more, that we just, like, there's so many, you know, great fiction films that are based on real people, and there's so many great documentaries that are sort of very stylized, and it should just be films, you know.
It is sort of an artificial dichotomy between the two.
Yeah.
I always have been interested in this kind of, if I'm making a, I don't do many fiction films. I did 2 feature films that are fiction. But the reality component is bigger than ever. This is why I don't do so much feature films until I shot one 12 years ago, and I shot another one 2 years ago before Wei Wei Film. And that piece was really interesting because it was with a big, big component of reality and how to put the characters in reality, how to move them around. And talking about what you were proposing, I believe that I mostly, as a DP, I work with women directors, mostly. It hasn't changed for me because I'm in sets that they are ruled by women. So it's great. And in the productions I make, we are not tolerating jokes, hard jokes. In Mexico, we joke a lot, like really heavy. And we are not tolerating jokes that they're like aggressive to gender qualities. I don't know how to say it in English.
Yeah.
To gender. So, but it's not changing that much because in my company, we're really like...
You were already there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So we are just making an effort to people to not be heavy on jokes. Don't be like that. Mexico is a country that always is having these kind of waves and talking about this since many years. This is kind of a changing, but I don't know in the industry size films. I don't know. I make small films. It doesn't matter if it's small production teams, like a documentary is like four people. The chamber where we were like seven, eight with the actress. Yeah, that was like that. Yeah. So
maybe Eric can speak to this too, but I noticed we shot on 35mm, and a few years ago there was a flat spot kind of in technical proficiency and willingness to work with film. You know, especially with the younger crew, they hadn't really come up with it. And the older crew had kind of moved on to a level that you kind of can't afford on the indie level. And they don't really want to work with stuff. And kind of the infrastructure and the resources were not really there. And especially in New York. And that has kind of crept back in now.
New York has a lab.
New York has a lab, finally. And more support for rental houses. And, you know, a new generation that's coming up now, you know, that is interested in it and exploring it and takes it very seriously and wants to really know it and take pride in kind of adding that to their stable of skills. And but it was hard. It's definitely still hard, you know, and like finding people who are willing to like not light off of a monitor, like a gaffer that can work with a light meter and, you know, and that you could trust, and a focus puller who doesn't need to look at a monitor, and you know,
and finding a director that understands that VideoTap doesn't look like the final image.
Definitely, that is a big one.
Yeah, or a producer.
Yeah, I mean, we shot 40-year-old version on 35mm black and white, but we had a lot of night exteriors and kind of like low light level things, and at our budget level, like it was not really possible to like get a condor up at the end of the block, you know, and blast light down the street, which like. Probably could have done it for a night or two, but also that's not what night in New York looks like, you know, and so I was really trying to be true to that. And so we ended up shooting on 5219, which is like a 500T color stock, and pushing it two stops, which looks great after you develop it, but the tap is just nothing.
Yeah.
Like, so we might as well not have had
There's
tap.
Like one dot of a street light.
Yeah,
it's,
and you know what I mean?
It.
Like you're seeing the street lights and you're seeing traffic lights and like... You know, people are like, well, where are their faces? And I'm like, you'll see it next week.
And it is interesting seeing the difference, too. I work with some directors who do more comedy stuff, and they're always watching a monitor and rolling through takes. And I think that that's also wonderful and effective. But Jay was always looking at the actors, like basically standing right next to the lens, looking at the action, or looking away and listening. And that's the first time I've ever worked with a director that did that. We're really just like zeroing in on specific things. And it kind of changed the energy of the notes and of the day.
Well, it changes the energy of space, too. All of a sudden, the actors, the director, and the camera person are all together in the same space, shared together. Whereas a lot of times when the energy goes to Video Village, and Video Village is maybe like a room away or something, it just feels like a very split energy to me.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's like theater. You know what I mean? It's, you know... Very few people enjoy watching a recording of a play.
Yeah.
But when you're in the room, it's magical.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, I think, with whether a DP operates or, you know, watches monitor. If a director is in the room or watches off monitor, you know, when everyone's in the same room and in the same space, there's things happening that, like, you can't be explained.
So has anyone worked with an intimacy coordinator yet this year? All we are talking about at school, we're doing intimacy coordinator workshops. It's like very much.
Why don't you tell us about it real brief? I'm curious about it.
Yeah, so when I read it in your email, I was like, what it is?
Oh,
something
yeah.
like that.
So it is a brand new job.
Yeah,
like 2 years ago, it wasn't a thing. But now there's intimacy coordinators. And if you are doing an intimate scene, you hire them to come to set and they help you. It's like having a fight coordinator. They help you block the scene. They help navigate the whole experience. It is a new and oncoming thing that literally like 3 years ago, there weren't any. And now they are. And it's increasingly becoming a thing. And we're at Fierstein, like we are like requiring you to do a, like, we're bringing in intimacy coordinators for all the students to do a workshop with before your second year films. And if you don't go to the workshop, like, we're not going to do your second year films. Like, it's going to be part of our training, because it is about, like, you know, it's a complicated thing doing, yeah, like, intimate scenes. And intimate scenes can mean all sorts of things. Like, in our intimacy guidelines, like, you know, a long hug, like, or if you have a child actor and you're, like, holding the child actor by the arm, like, all of those things are, anytime two people have physical contact, there's something involved in that. And some directors are better at navigating it than others, but a director is always going to have all these needs they have. So the same way you bring in a fight coordinator to make sure the actors are safe, because the director might not be the best at worrying about the safety in a fight because they want to get the shot, you bring in an intimacy coordinator to make sure that the actors feel completely safe, because the director, even if they're a very sensitive person, has other things they're worrying about on the shoot day.
In Mexico, we used to have people that do that. It was in the directorial department, ADs, that when I used to work in bigger productions, like in the big industry, like as an AD, and we talked, like, who is a good AD for this scene? Who is that? Yeah, it was an AD thing. And we used to work that way, yeah.
That's kind of how it worked when I was coming up too, yeah. The AD, or, you know what I mean? The AD was generally...
Yeah, the, you know, responsible to be, like, yeah, in the mood, in the respect, and everything.
Which worked sometimes, and sometimes didn't.
Yeah, yeah. But this is why we make in the curriculum. That guy is good for those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think also part of it is by having a person who's dedicated, who's like, that is their only job, the performers feel like they're someone that they could go to with any concerns. Whereas, like, you don't always feel like the AD is someone, especially because ADs are very time conscious, if you're asking a question that might slow things down and you're a performer, the AD might not be the person you want to have that conversation with. Yeah. But that's interesting. Yeah, I mean...
But the AD also is responsible for security and safety. Everything. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the end, safety is...
Yeah, safety.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. Well, I'm going to keep asking the question every year, and eventually some DPs will have some fun stories about, like... Because, you know, it's like things are changing.
Well, there's a heightened consciousness, I think, no matter what. Like, in our project, we had, for example, one shot that was a point of view. The actor is on the bed, and we had to, someone sits beside her, and we had to get his point of view. And the only way I could do that was effectively to, like, sit on top of her. But it was like, you know, you have to get into the feeling of what you're doing and communicate, be like, okay, well, like, it, you know, if something feels weird, just let me know. I'm going to scoot up. I'm going to scoot away. In this shot, we have to do this. And I think just that tone and that, like, way of communicating. So even if there's not an intimacy coordinator on set, there's one, like, in your brain,
yeah,
you know, and that you're kind of thinking of that. And if you can't afford one, which I don't know, maybe people can't, I think that there should still be, like, the ethos of one, or maybe, like, a little kind of, like, set on set speech that someone gives or something like that, which we also did. And so that really helped. And even in the absence of a coordinator, you know, you still have to, you'll get a better performance, I think, if you communicate crew member to crew member, whether it's a grip setting a C stand, or you know, a sound person putting a lav on talent, like, all those things matter, especially in the doc world. I mean, you know, you're going into a situation where you've never met someone, and then you have to put a lav in their shirt.
And I mean, I think it's going to get added to the safety meeting. Like, I hear at big studio levels, it is already part of the morning safety meeting. It is already part of the, like, we have the giant meeting before production starts where everybody comes out and we meet with coordinators, and, like, it is just, it's becoming part of the culture, because film set culture keeps changing. Definitely. Like, film sets feel wildly different than they did in the 90s when, like, there weren't really cell phones yet, except the producers had cell phones, but nobody else did. And it was just a much different atmosphere. I kind of miss that. But
I also saw a lot of things on set in the 90s that I was like, whoa.
Oh, yeah.
Let me never let that happen on my set.
Yeah. But,
and, you know, as far as, like, these are, like, the way pre-intimacy coordinator days where it's like,
but it used to be
education, and, like,
but if you were low on the totem pole, it was very much something where you were like, I'm like, you know, the power dynamics of film was you wouldn't really challenge it, right? Like,
you still wouldn't challenge it.
I feel like we're getting to a place where I think more people might, maybe. I definitely remember in the 90s sneaking around, the producer told us to dump out this fish tank that was full of fish. And so we started to do it, but we couldn't kill all the fish. So we, like, snuck off and put them in a bag so we could take them back to the store. But we didn't want the producer to see that we weren't killing all the fish. Because, it was...
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
Someone told you to do that.
This podcast is sponsored by Rode Microphones, the Australian pro audio powerhouse making incredible gear for podcasters, vloggers, filmmakers, and musicians. Rode is at the vanguard of innovation for audio solutions for podcasters, offering groundbreaking products like the Rodecaster Pro, the world's first fully integrated podcast production studio, and PodMic, the ultimate podcasting microphone. Find out more about how Rode can help you cut through the noise at rode.com/podcasting. That's rode.com/podcasting. This podcast was recorded using Rode microphones and technology. Founded by a group of independent filmmakers, SmallHD has been innovating the on-camera and production monitor industry for an entire decade. It started by creating the first ever HD monitor that could sit on top of a DSLR. Today, its products include the 703 Bolt that has an integrated wireless receiver and a daylight viewable screen. SmallHD is in the business of providing real-time confidence for creatives. With an extremely wide range of field monitors, SmallHD prides itself on durability and usability. Whether it's paired with a mirrorless camera during a wedding or used for Video Village in Hollywood, SmallHD has a monitor for every production. Powerful software tools, a unified user experience, and premium display quality help make SmallHD monitors the industry standard. Stop wondering if you've nailed the shot. Start having more confidence at the camera with SmallHD. On-camera and production monitors starting at just $299. For more information about SmallHD products, go to smallhd.com. And then the other big thing, obviously, that's changing a lot is larger sensors, right? In a less fraught, more technical conversation, larger sensors. I've been shooting a lot on the Arri LF in the last 6 months or so, and it's like, it is radically different in feeling in a way that, like, there is a lot more abstract differences than I was expecting there to be as that. So has anybody been moving over to large format? I mean, we've got a couple 35 millimeters, so that's traditional size. Have anybody had large format shoots lately? Or?
I'm about to shoot my next feature film in the Alexa LF.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, but I'm not. I really don't like the new lenses. So
the Signature Primes?
I haven't tried the Signature because we don't have it in Mexico. But for example, we tried the size, and I wouldn't like the look. I normally go to vintage lenses. My whole feature films have been into like Speed Pancras or Super Baltars or that kind of stuff. And for this one, I found this double Speed Pancra, which were the Speed Pancra for Vista Vision.
Yeah.
So they cover the big sensor.
There are like three sets in the world.
Yeah. There are three sets in the world.
And where are you getting this set?
From LA.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, a Mexican, Rodrigo Iturralde. Yeah. Guy has this company called La Fin Boutique.
Yeah.
Started to buy crazily old glasses when they weren't popular and rehousing them. And they have this crazy amount of just nice, incredible old lenses. And I tried them like in December, actually during the Thanksgiving. And they look great with the new sensor. So I'm starting to figure out how they look, how to make this newer image kind of in cinema. With those old glasses to make it something new, because my new movie is about like exploring the idea of how black and white film looks like. So I'm doing it black and white and make it like a moving image, you know, like if you go to a gallery to see a photograph, but something like that, explore that idea. So the bigger sensor give me this like depth of field that you can play with, and also it's all exterior with these huge mountains in Oaxaca, Mexico too. So it's really interesting to me to explore this larger sensor.
Yeah, I have the new FX9.
Sony, oh yeah,
and I'm start testing with the set of lenses I have that I have used in four documentaries, maybe Nikon AIS. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful set, and people is using it a lot. Jaime just start using it in a big sensor too, and. I'm testing. I will make a film, like I will start in probably 4 months, like a new documentary from myself. But I'm testing because I'm not really sure about many things. The lenses I'm sure about because I know them.
But also FX9 is sort of an interesting move because you like doc, you don't really think of as being full frame. You know, you like a smaller sensor in doc. I still like shooting 2/3 inch on doc.
Yeah.
But like Sony really is convinced that doc is ready for full frame and that the autofocus is like when you need it, it's going to be there. And it's interesting to hear you got an FX9 actually.
The focus thing is really, I think, with the depth of field. I did a commercial on a Venice this week, and the depth of field thing was really, really crazy because,
yeah,
you know, it's like at a, like a 40 mil at a two, it's still razor thin.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, I can't imagine how I would carry that into the narrative space where, you know, you have to tell a story and have information in a frame.
Yeah.
You know, like a set or other actors or, you know, like.
Or how to do an indie feature where you're like, I've got to move quickly and I've got a lot of setups in the day. And it's like, you know, because Arri LF is, I mean, Arri Mini is the dominant camera of Sundance every year, right? It's always like 60% of the Sundance movies. And even though there's a Mini LF, I don't know that that's going to change. I think the Mini and then the new Super 35 Arri that's coming out next year are still going to be the Sundance camera because LF is hard on an indie schedule.
I haven't shot anything large format yet, but I have a film coming up in the fall that we're looking at large format for, specifically for that. It's kind of like about a character becoming isolated from her environment. And we specifically are thinking about doing LF to be able to, like, be on her and have the, everything else go away. I'm not sure why people are excited about it, to be honest.
Because like, it's new?
Yeah, like people are really going crazy for it, but I haven't really seen it used in a way yet where I'm like, okay, this is something new. I guess parts of Joker I think were great.
I believe that the use of different perspective, more than the depth of field for me, yeah. I do a lot of dog work, so I'm not that much into the race. The only thing in focus is this pin.
Yeah.
No, I'm not in that. But the option of lenses they're using to use 28, to use 20, like in the scenes deal. In dog, for me is like.
Like inside really of a great. Car or something. Like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. It's amazing because.
I was going to say, you also get this crazy sense of presence. Like I shot an 18 millimeter close up on it. On full frame, and I was like, I just feel more present with you in a way than I do on like if it was a 14 and Super 35, it'd be like the same field of view, but it just doesn't feel, there's like something about the gate being bigger that makes me feel closer to the person in an interesting way. But I don't think it's the right it's thing for everything.
I think anamorphic scratches that itch for me.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So It's interesting, like thinking about a lot of the perspective changes and things that people are talking about in LF is just something that in my mind it's like, well, that's an anamorphic movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I feel I like more spherical in general. Yeah. So now I'm like, okay, now I can play with that.
Yeah. All right, so we've only got a little bit of time left. If we want to talk a little bit about like Sundance experiences, I don't know how many years people have been coming. Is it anybody's first year at Sundance?
We are three.
Three?
Please.
Yeah, so like, what have we seen so far? What have our experiences been so far? Or people who are repeat, anything about Sundance that seems different?
I haven't seen any film, and I'm discovering the festival, and I'm completely, how you say, confused? I'm confused about the festival because I don't know how to get to the film theater and see a thing.
So oh, yeah.
I will start tomorrow. I just was to the premiere to my film, the Ai Weiwei film. And I'm discovering because I'm overwhelmed of.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah, I'm used to more used to festivals like Toronto and maybe some European festivals and than this. This is, I was like, okay, and everybody's looking at your badge and saying, "Oh, hi, how are you? Who are you?" And I'm like, I'm shy. It's like that.
It seems like to me, I noticed that there's a lot of stuff that even across. Documentary, across shorts, across narrative, etc. It seems like there's a lot of stuff from all around the world, and that's not just foreign productions. I've seen like there's some U.S. films that were shot overseas, and I think that that's really cool. And I don't know how that compares to times in the past, but I'm certainly more aware of it now than I ever was. And it's I always think it's cool when people from different places work in new places because you have a perspective that you don't see.
Cool.
Well, I did want to. Can I go back to your first question?
You can go back to anything. Yeah.
I vote Thank for that. You. I vote for that.
I mean, like the documentary industry is different, so most of the directors I work with are women. But like I don't know. Like female DPs don't work as often, so I don't actually. I think it's like slowly changing, but I don't think it's changed yet.
Yeah.
So, Just saying.
You think it's the beginning of the change?
It is. Like, I still work less than everyone else does, right? And I definitely, like, a lot of my female DP friends, we all complain about how we get hired for the same projects. It's like, we need the female DP for the sexual assault film, or we need an all-female crew.
But you're not booking you're not getting the next Fast and the Furious movie.
But that's not documentaries. Like, yeah. You pick projects because they're important to you, and you are on them for 3 years, so you have to be invested in the material. It's just funny that we all only now get hired for those movies. It's like always the all-female crew, which is lovely and great and fun, but
is Free the Work changing?
Feels token, maybe, right?
Yeah, it's become that way. It's like definitely a sentiment that I think a lot of other people are feeling.
Yeah, I mean, DPs of color for sure. It's like, I'll never shoot a Jennifer Aniston movie. That's not going to be offered to me.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember a Jennifer Aniston movie, but yeah, I guess there are Jennifer Aniston. Yeah.
I will say, though, in terms of crews, I used to work more in documentaries, so I haven't had a long crew life, you know? Mm-hmm. But even just in the last few years, seeing the awareness and interest in having gender and racial equity kind of on crews is just, even that people are talking about it means that something is changing. Like, that it's part of the discourse from the hiring perspective. And I don't know if that's token or not. Maybe for some people it might be, but
I think people are more conscious of it, which is great. I also will say, in a plus side, there are so many female ACs now. Yeah. And I was a female AC, and I AC'd for Wolfgang.
Oh.
And there weren't any, like, I don't have any friends that are my direct peers that were women that were when I was an AC. But now, like, my roster of, like, ACs, like, I don't work with any men. Like, they're all women. So that's
So the pipeline incredible. Is filling up for
it's
the future.
It's filling up. It's coming up, right?
And that's the farm. That's the bench, really.
Yeah, you know, for which the is future. Fantastic. Yeah. Like, I think it's really – and that's normal for them. Like, they don't – I was talking to a girl about this recently – and it's amazing that she had no idea. I mean, I don't think I realized how weird it was that I didn't know any other women at the time when I was an AC, like, that all my friends were guys. Yeah. And so it's really kind of interesting that shift is happening and that they don't realize how special it is, which is good.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, it's not special. Ideally, it's just, like, normal.
It is the normal.
Yeah. But you think we're in the very, very, very beginning of any change happening.
Yeah, change takes a long time. Yeah. You can't just, like, start change and expect it immediately.
I mean, look at this table, you know? I mean, look at all the all the productions I've been doing over the years. It's getting better, but we still have to point out, oh, it's watched out by a woman. It's still a special thing. It's not like this is the very beginning.
And it does feel like camera
but
was
it's
the
also
last.
It's also exciting because I think it does change the language. I think there's actually different sensibilities. I mean, it's not black and white, but I think there's definitely different in fiction. I think some of the female DPs have just brought just different sensibilities and just in the storytelling, and I think it's just, but we're at the beginning. I agree with Jenny.
But even in products too, like now, like there's like Easy Rig,
yeah,
is aware of that the body shape of
yeah,
women
except that like no rental houses have that
really,
and it costs $5,000.
We haven't gotten to the point where women are running the rental houses yet.
So, also, yeah.
I don't know any female rental house owners.
No,
not a one.
Oh, that is actually a really good point.
No, there is one in L.A.
Bicini. There's Bicini.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, G&E and, like, all that stuff, true. Don't know a single one.
Yeah.
I think a lot of this stuff is, like, above-the-line, visible stuff, but it's not, you know.
The infrastructure.
Well, people aren't conscious of it. If it's not your world and you're not thinking about it, then why would you include it? That's all.
I used to have these weird conversations with my gaffer. I have known him for 20 years. And I start forcing, because at first I ask, oh, can you include some women? And he said, yeah, I can, but they're not prepared and we need to go fast. And the first year it was like that. And then I realized, I don't care. Include it. If it's not prepared, it will be prepared after the shoot. But it was like weird talks. Now he's completely conscious about and he's working with and he's looking for. But you need to force it. That's something. Every change needs to be forced.
Well,
in my point of view.
But also, how many times has there been like somebody's cousin on G&E or somebody's little brother on G&E that everybody knows is slower in learning and everybody's training and it's okay and nobody ever thinks about it? And that's not something anybody ever questions. Yeah. But then the idea of like deliberately bringing in someone to the crew who is a woman who doesn't know as much is then something people's resistant to. But like, there are often people who are greener on a set and nobody blinks if it's, you know, the little brother. I hadn't intended this to be the wrap-up conversation, but I think it is a good wrap-up conversation.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. All right, well, thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it. And thank you guys all so much for making time in your Sundance schedule. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, yeah.
Thank you for the invitation.
So that was our first Cinematographer's Roundtable, a really enjoyable conversation. If you want more, you can check out nofilmschool.com, where we have all sorts of Sundance coverage and podcasts, and we do a regular weekly podcast, the No Film School podcast, where we talk about what's going on in filmmaking. And you can always follow us on the Twitters and the Facebooks, No Film School, and look forward to seeing you out and about in the world.